Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and I have with me George Finney, one of the people who have actually implemented Zero Trust. He's written a book about it, and now he's applied it to AI. George, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, tell me a little bit about your background and yourself.
Yeah, so I've been a CISO for a number of years. It's been such a crazy run. I work in higher education. So I feel like if we can do zero trust in higher education, where the students give us kind of free pen testing, our networks are, you know, anybody can come and walk onto the campus. If we can make prevention and zero trust work here, we're in one of the most highly challenging environments, I think we can do it anywhere, right? And that's part of why I wrote the book. I really believe that it does work. It's a strategy, right? So, you know, it helps guide really everything we do.
So you work as a CISO, work in academia, which is, I always used to joke, you should put your firewalls in backwards to protect the world from your students. And a good friend of mine who just recently retiring as a CISO at Virginia Tech, Randy Marchaney, he's been there for 50 years, not as a CISO, but, you know, I guess going from undergraduate days and things like that. And he's been an iconic member of our industry. I had a chance to teach with him at SANS for a number of years. And he had said his big problem there was that you're almost running an ISP. You've got a core, which is such a high amount of information. You can't filter in that. You can't go in there. It's almost like a power distribution where you've got the 40,000 or 20,000 volts up there. You got to leave that alone. But when it steps down to 440 or 110, then you can go ahead and do something about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're not just an ISP. We're a business. We're a high research center. We have event venues where we play football or have concerts. We're an apartment complex for students that live on campus. We have health centers, generally speaking, or hospitals. So everything, you know, it's like a little microcosm here, a tiny little city. So, it's been a really fun place to kind of, grow up in. And I say grow up, I've been here a long time, but it's been a lot of fun.
Interesting. Now, of course, I mentioned earlier, you wrote a book on this stuff, and I've always got admiration. My co-host Ross Young put out his first book in November, and so you've got a book out. But tell me a little bit more about it and how it has to do with zero trust.
Yeah, so I've got a couple of books. The first one, Project Zero Trust, really looks at it's a fictional case study in a fictional company and characters. That actually go through the whole process. So you see zero trust not just from the lens of a security leader or even a security practitioner. You're getting that perspective from the help desk or from a network engineer's perspective or an identity person or even project managers or your CEO. They always say when you write a book, you know, show, don't tell. This approach has really resonated with people. Whether you've been in security for 20 years or whether you're just starting out and don't really have a background in technology, the new book. So the first one's called Project Zero Trust. The second one is called Rise of the Machines. So the same company.
Sounds rather ominous.
Yeah, you know, I do a lot of pop culture references in the book. So obviously, you know, with AI, you got to get a Terminator reference in there somewhere. Being able to talk about AI and how you do zero trust with AI has been, just, I think, really eye opening for folks. The whole point of telling a story is to make zero trust and cybersecurity in general more approachable for folks, right? We need more people, to be able to help us out and solve our challenges these days.
Yeah. Now, a lot of times we take a look in our cybersecurity world, and a lot of the books are written are either rather dry or they're rather academic or they're very, very prescriptive. But I know Gene Kim was rather successful with the Phoenix Project in turning to fiction, and you've chosen fiction as well. Why do you think that's a better way to convey your message than a simple, if you will, textbook?
Yeah, so I've had the privilege to teach cybersecurity at one of the best universities in the world. And the crazy thing is, you know, as I was, you know, getting to know the material and getting to know the students, I just realized, you know, it's not just that it's boring or dry. How we talk about like encryption is really mystifying for folks that are new to security. I realized during that course that, man, we were probably making cyber even more challenging the way we were teaching it. So my whole goal over the last decade has been to make cybersecurity more approachable so that everyone can kind of play the role we need them to play, not just in security, but, you know, in IT or with our execs or business leaders as well.
That's a very good insight, because as we're realizing cybersecurity is everybody's responsibility, we may take the lead as a CISO. We might be the person who's ultimately accountable for how things work out, but we have to train and equip our people to be able to respond effectively. So if we go back to, let's say, 2010, a little guy by the name of Kindervag came up with a concept called Zero Trust. Tell me a little about what you know about that fine gentleman and what got you inspired on this path.
You know, John and I are friends. He just happens to live in Dallas, as do I. So we got to know each other over the years. So, and I got kind of this call out of the blue to write a book on Zero Trust. And I was like, I've written a couple of books. Let me just introduce you to John. And they're like, man, he won't return our calls. He's too busy. I'm texting him while I'm having the call with the publisher. And, you know, ultimately, you know, he and I sat down over a weekend on his couch, and I was kicking around this fictional case study. And he's just like, look, here are all my notes. You go do this. And carry that torch for Zero Trust. And it's been amazing to have, you know, that level of support from someone who really believes in you and believes in the message that you can go deliver. I've just been really humbled through the whole process. It's been incredible. I don't know how I wound up here, but it's been an amazing journey.
Well, yeah, you take it. I mean, life sometimes gives you some interesting hands that you get to play. Here's a thought. If we take a look at Zero Trust, I think a lot of people tend to think of it as a bunch of technical controls. But I think your approach is more of an organizational strategy. Maybe if we level set, why don't you say, you know, what basically goes into Zero Trust? I mean, do we encrypt everything and we trust and we authenticate everything? Is it a little bit more than that? And let's build up from that foundation.
Yeah, so I used Kindervag's definition. I can't claim credit for it, but his definition is that Zero Trust is a strategy. It's a strategy for preventing or containing breaches by removing the trust relationships we have in digital systems. As long as I've been a CISO, I've focused on prevention because, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I'd much prefer to prevent bad things from happening than to have to spend weeks or months or years trying to dig out. But the last part of that, John actually led a group of pen testers at the beginning of his career. And this resonates with me and all the work that I've done. The thing that the bad guys target, right, the thing that they need to get in to go do whatever it is they're going to go do is trust. We have this anthropomorphization of computers, like it's George's computer, it's George's packets. And that's not the case. We don't implicitly trust anything when it comes to computers, because we can't distinguish between George's packets or John's packets or what have you. So, but having that core strategy that's directing you is really the key part of that.
So you indicated that you're basically, we're going to tear down the assumed trust relationships between our systems, and we're going to rebuild them in a better way. And it's in line with what we're seeing a lot in terms of attack strategies. Today's attackers don't break into your systems. They log into your systems.
Right.
They're phishing the users. They're going ahead and they're doing credential harvesting. They're doing a kind of a adversary in the middle attacks. They're able to go ahead and grab information off of endpoints because they've got info stealers. And so as a result, you have what otherwise would look like a perfectly legitimate communications, but it's not. Now, I've worked in military environments where there's extremely high security, and so you have to validate an awful lot of things. You can't go to the bathroom without going ahead, probably, and validating who you are. Definitely on the way back in, you have to come back and reprove who you are. Just the fact that I'm in the building didn't make sense to get back into the operations center. Just the fact that I had been there 5 minutes ago wasn't good enough for me to get back into the operations center. If I stepped out of that door, I had to complete a full three-factor authentication to come back in again. But we understood that, and that was part of the requirement, so that became part of our culture. Now, do we find that zero trust, can we implement that in a way that's not going to grate against the culture of our organization? Because most people just want to sit down and go to work. And if we put more and more impediments in there, I have found that people will try five times as hard to get around a control than they will to just accept it. And so that's the human culture that we deal with. How does zero trust, effectively implemented, deal with that?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating question, right? So culture, you know, if you read Peter Drucker, the famous management guru, you know, he likes to say culture eats strategy for breakfast.
And my corollary to that, by the way, is culture eats policy for lunch.
Yeah. So, you know, when you read his treatise on culture, right, it's really about, you know, leaders come in and they have these great strategies. Zero trust is a strategy. But they don't understand the day-to-day of how the people living in that environment are going to implement, right? They don't have empathy for the employees. There's that disconnect. And so that's really the value of culture. And I think, you know, a lot of folks, when they hear zero trust, they think we don't trust people too. And right, again, the definition was really about focusing on digital systems. But the whole reason that you have a strategy is because you need to get a group of people working towards the same goal, working in the same direction. And, you know, what I found is, you know, there's this myth that, you know, security is always going to be a trade-off, whether, you know, performance versus, you know, security, usability versus security. And I think one of the things that comes out of the zero trust strategy, knowing that you need to be sensitive to the culture, you've got to find opportunities to improve security at the same time that you're working with the business to improve their outcomes as well, right? You're a part of a team, and the goal of a business isn't to be secure. The goal of the business is to do whatever the business does. You have to be an enabler for that. And that has to be a critical part of the culture. And, you know, again, you got to reinforce, look, we're not changing the way the business runs. We want to enable the business to get the job done while being secure.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think of physical analogies. Often when I teach cybersecurity, I try to take things and bring them back down to something that every person would understand, even if they have no IT background whatsoever. What are your thoughts in terms of explaining the concept of zero trust to somebody which are not allowed to use IT?
You know, I've had really great conversations with our executives, and one of the things that resonates with them is they know that any part of the business to be successful has to have a strategy for success. And I think that just that part, like, oh, okay, yeah, totally, we need a strategy. You know, are there other strategies in security? Well, I don't know that they live up to that. But in terms of an analogy, the analogy Kindervag always uses is the Secret Service and the president, right? So, you know, you've got multiple perimeters, right? You know, you focused on what's important, right? The life safety of the president. And you work outward from there. And so that strategy translates into protect surfaces. It translates into to kind of, you know, mobile perimeters, right? Wherever the president's going. That I think is the one analogy that you can kind of like start to see. Kindervag has this slide where, you know, you've got the limo and then the crowd, you know, the Secret Service agents in between. That's what we want for our networks. That's what we want for our critical data is to have that concept of a protect surface and ensure that nothing's going to go wrong there.
So it sounds conceptually wonderful. So if I go to RSAC in a couple months and I say, I'd like to buy $100,000 worth of zero trust. That's my budget. I don't think that it works that way because, as you said, it's a strategy, not a product. And yet there's a lot of companies out there that have zero trust at the core of what they do and things such as that. And so as we look at what's out there in terms of the vendor space and the like, what is it that we look for? For example, ThreatLocker runs an event called Zero Trust World. It'll be March 4th to 6th right here in Orlando, Florida.
You know, there are a lot of products out there that will help you scale your zero trust program, right? You don't have to have a tool to do zero trust, right? You can harden your systems. You can, you know, go through your firewall policies and craft it in the zero trust mode. So zero trust isn't a product. And I think that makes it, right? And nobody's out there selling what you have to do in terms of a strategy. That's something that we as security leaders have to own to be successful. Frankly, right, when I've talked to other CISOs that have, you know, done zero trust and failed, it's not about the technology, right? It's not that they didn't have budget. It's not that they couldn't go out and get these, you know, cool tools to go do stuff with. It's really about politics. It's about siloed communication and, it comes back to people. I think people are the most important part of security. And you can't do all of those things, unless you've got great communication, unless you've got great planning, having that strategy to get all of those people, working together instead of, you know, operating in their own, silos is hard, but it's not something a vendor can go do for you.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's not a vendor solution. It's not a put disk one into drive A and hit enter and you're all set. For those of us who remember what the A drive is, I still have some leftover relics from a previous era. But as you had pointed out, it's a political problem. It's a people problem, even though at a technical base, it's about communication, trust, or reforming the trust among devices. And so for CISOs who have attempted and failed to do zero trust or who are struggling with it, the problem is not going to be the technology. The technology is there. The vendors have created excellent solutions to go out there. The strategy documents are there. You can read John Kindervag's writings. You can read your book and things such as that. What is it that you think causes, and I think you alluded to it, the frustrations for CISOs, and what key tips would you offer them to get them up and over that edge that they might be facing?
Yeah, I think, you know, again, if the main, you know, reason that zero trust projects go astray is politics, I think we as security leaders need to be more than technologists. I think we've got to challenge ourselves to work on our communication skills, to build partnerships and relationships with folks, right? And I think I came up through the technical ranks, right? I did a bunch of different jobs in IT before I ultimately landed in security. And, you know, a career in IT does not necessarily prep you to talk to other human beings, right? I mean,
great place if you're an introvert.
Same, right? So I think that's really the challenge is getting into the wetware, right? In terms of your connections with other humans and changing the way you frame that conversation, right? My biggest pet peeve in security is we've got an unofficial motto in security, right? We all know, we've all heard it. You know, we say people are the weakest link. If that's your mindset, how are you going to have great relationships with other human beings that rely on you? When you think they're all part of the problem, I like to say that the people are the only link, right? You know, we talk about, you know, security like it's people, processes, and technology, but really it's people, you know, building the technology, configuring it, using it. It's people creating the processes and following them or not. So again, it all comes back to people. And, you know, that's how we transform the organization, is collaborating with humans. And, you know, again, if you're starting out with the perspective that people are the problem, I think it's natural that politics and silos and communication challenges are going to be the thing that trips you up.
Really good insight on that. So now when we look at the people issue, I won't call it a problem. We'll call it an issue or a challenge. Okay. Well, we're going to look at this positively. What are the core constituencies that we really need to get on side to be able to effectively implement a zero trust strategy? I don't think it's HR, but maybe it is. I don't think it's finance, but maybe it is. But what are the core constituents?
You know, I would say every business, you know, leader, department heads, you've got to get to know them and understand how, you know, they think, how their department functions in order to really understand and align with the business, right? We've talked about aligning with the business for a long time in security, but, you know, that requires a deep understanding of like how the business makes money. It's not, you know, there's no one way perfect to get it right. There's no wrong way to eat a Reese's, I think figuring out all of those little tendrils and helping people be successful while being secure is huge. But I also like to come back, like every part of the business already does some aspect of security, whether it's legal, helping review contracts to make sure the organization doesn't get into trouble. Audit, obviously, they're trying to prevent issues. You know, the finance group is actively trying to prevent fraud financially through you know, they're making sure people aren't embezzling. There's so many parts of the business that are already doing security. I think it really does look like a team effort when you see it from that lens. But going back to the question, what's the most critical thing? I actually like to say I've been really relying on project management. So some organizations have a project management office. Some people just have, you know, a couple of folks to be able to do that for them. But to collaborate well and to make sure that Zero Trust is being executed requires planning. You've got to figure out the rest of the organization's roadmap and where you can fit into that, where products are being delivered, where people are making natural changes, and you can work with them to get on board and do security at the same time. I've found, you know, that's probably maybe the most underutilized part of the organization to help drive security change. And we got to get out of firefighting. Projects to help transform security and to eliminate whole categories of issues. I think that's really been a core part of my zero trust philosophy for a while.
So I think working backwards from the concept of we want to avoid breaches. A lot of breaches occur due to lateral movement. Lateral movement occurs because there is an ability to gain trust between two different entities or more, but that it's an inappropriate level of trust. A breach of a single system where one laptop catches fire or whatever, okay, that might happen and we can isolate that pretty quickly. We've got EDR and we've got other types of tools. They're going to detect that and allow us to respond. But really the bigger challenge, what we're seeing is a systemic concern where a low and slow adversary or a deep access that persists over time. And that adversary could be internal as well. It could be a disgruntled employee, because you never know when someone goes from gruntled to disgruntled. They don't advertise that. Although I did have a button, I got to find it. I got it at Disney World years ago. It's a disgruntled employee of the month. It's a fun thing to wear. Just kind of mess with people's heads. But where I'm going with this is that is we're trying to convince people to say, well, hey, things work pretty well here. We don't need to re-engineer all these little interconnections and stuff like that because life is fine. It's almost an argument to say, well, why do I need airbags and why do I need anti-lock brakes? And why even need to wear a seatbelt? I've been driving for 30 years and I've never had an accident. Well, of course, it's not so much the steady state. Yes, there is going to be some change in the steady state, but ultimately, once it's implemented, at the zero trust level, that's all taking place at the technical level. Users not having to go ahead and re-authenticate every 2 minutes. That's not going to be an impact on them. But the opportunity for persistent attacks goes pretty close to zero. Is that a true statement? And can I claim that if I do zero trust correctly?
You know, I think it's hard to get to zero in the zero trust, right? It's the journey. It's not the destination. But you know, the reason that that's the case is our organizations are always evolving, changing, adopting new technology. The bad guys are always evolving and creating new techniques, right? It's a cat and mouse game that we're fighting on a daily basis, right? So, you know, I think, you know, a lot of what you have to do is prioritization, right? What are my biggest issues? And, you know, hopefully cover enough of your bases to stay secure. But, you know, there's always those, you know, servers that are about to be decommissioned. We're not going to patch them. We're going to turn them off in a minute. Those are inevitably the things that people forget about and that come back to bite you.
Now, one of the things that, of course, has been the real trend for the last several months is AI. AI is in everything. It's about everything. It's been a really good performer in your portfolio if you were wise enough to buy some of it. But again, you can't really just back up to the stock market and say, I want to buy AI and things like that. You can't back up and buy zero trust. But as we go ahead and we start to incorporate these AI systems, what is the challenge with respect to zero trust as we adopt AI, and what should we be doing in advance to protect for that?
Gosh, I love this question, right? AI is just all over the place all of a sudden. And, you know, I'll talk about, you know, one of the breaches that happened last year. You know, we naturally kind of think about, like, I'm never going to put PII on a public facing website, right? We've kind of gotten, you know, better at that over the years. So when you see these chatbots that people have stood up that are on public facing websites that you can chat with, and you've trained them with, you know, your sensitive data or your research data or whatever, you know, your client lists. I mean, you've essentially exposed it on a public facing website, right? We used to be able to get that right, but we haven't translated that in our heads in order to protect those same systems. So, you know, I think it's learning something brand new. We're treating AI a little bit like it's magic, like we don't understand it. And I think it's so critical, you know, for everything we do in security, we're on the bleeding edge. And we have to be a part of the first response team to go, like, learn new stuff. So it you know, there's a lot that we're going to have to continue to learn as we're changing these trust models with AI. So I think it's an exciting time to be in security, but we can't reinvent the wheel, right? It's the same strategy that we're going to apply to be able to address those same issues.
Now, I think you have come up with something you call the restaurant analogy for AI. Tell me a little bit about that.
So, you know, again, people are thinking about AI like it's magic, and, you know, we're not applying our critical thinking skills yet. So you already know natively how AI works, because AI works like a restaurant. And I think this is really critical for folks to start to think about all of the different elements of AI to secure them, because just like with a restaurant, right, we can think about how a bad guy might go in and steal ingredients or steal the recipe. So the analogy is, you know, with AI, data is the place you start. It's the most important part of that. Just like, you know, ingredients in a restaurant. You might source your ingredients in a restaurant from multiple different vendors, but they all pull up to the back, you know, loading dock and do your deliveries. There's probably a pantry or some sort of storage area, freezer for your ingredients. You got to have that for your data. We know how to secure blob storage or S3 buckets or whatever. as you, you know, start to try and use the data, just like your ingredients, you need to clean and wash your vegetables. You got to chop them up. Same with data. You got to clean it up, normalize it, and prep it in order to be used in your models. When you get to the model, a model is just a recipe. You might be starting with an existing recipe for like a hamburger. Everybody knows how to make a hamburger. Or you might be a molecular gastronomist coming up with something nobody's ever thought of before, creating a whole new model. To do all of that AI stuff, you're going to have tools. So, you know, just like you in a restaurant, you have an oven or a fryer or a grill. And often, you know, the type of tools you have determine the type of restaurant you're going to be. Maybe you've got a crazy fancy Italian pizza oven, and you want to be, you know, the best Neapolitan pizza in the world. Anyway, as you get further into the restaurant, right, move out of the kitchen, now you're in the dining room, right? We generally speaking like to keep the customers out of the kitchen. So with AI, we've got serving infrastructure that the users can interact with, but we try and have some sort of separation with all the rest of the model. You know, in some cases we're looking at guardrails. In other cases, you know, maybe we've got an AI firewall, like a web application firewall in the middle to be a proxy. So that restaurant analogy, right, now that we've gone through it, well, I can see like an inference attack is really like someone posting, you know, bad Yelp reviews to get me to change my restaurant. You know, we can see someone sneaking in the back to steal our ingredients, just like people are trying to exfiltrate, you know, data from the underlying model. And I think, you know, again, we have to have a good analogy because, you know, again, we're in security. We need everybody to help. So people at the help desk need to know how AI works. People in IT, our executives, need to know how AI works in order to think critically about being able to protect it.
And I know I've faced this challenge as a CISO, a requirement by executives to say, we want to do AI. Okay, we got to do it correctly. And then, of course, we're doing the review and said, okay, we got Gemini and we got Copilot for everybody. And all of these people aren't using it, or they're using one but not the other. But everybody signed up for it and we're paying for it. And so what we're seeing then is that AI can be transformative in the business perspective if people know how to use it. But if they don't know how to use it, they're going to get down in a little rut and they're going to be, hey, this is what I do, and it's going to help me do my email, or it's going to help me with my calendar, and they're not going to realize what the full potential is. But as we look at embedding AI into app security and our custom models, and then we have machine learning, and then, of course, we have things like the Copilot, which goes along and sits and edits stuff, that's going to become more and more intrusive in the day-to-day operations of a business. Whether or not their employees are leaning into it, the capabilities are there. And by that, I mean the access to the information for the AI model is there. So as we look at this AI rollout, how do we go ahead and ensure that zero trust principles are part of the grounding of that? And then where do we go ahead and put the hard stops if we need to say, hey, time out. We really need to make sure that this is done correctly, because we're not going to get a chance to dig it all up and put it back in again without a significant amount of effort.
You know, I like to say that AI is 100% trust, right? So the technical difference in the way AI has been developed that's different from other technologies in the past is really about how they've collapsed the concept of a control plane and the data plane together. So with a router or a switch or a firewall, right, you had a whole separate module, or, you know, that wasn't in line, right? You need to connect to the console or an out-of-band connection to manage a firewall or a router. Same with HTML, right? You've got, you know, the instructions to the server or to the client, and you've got the data, and that's separate. With AI, we didn't do that. We're like, cool, let's give the instructions along with the data. And you know, that really does make AI 100% trust, which is why, right, when you ask an AI to give you something, it doesn't necessarily know it's not supposed to. That's why we need guardrails. That's why we need an AI firewall to be in that middle and to broker the conversations. And you know, I think as we apply it in all the different areas, whether it's a chatbot, whether it's an agent that's doing something on my behalf, whether it's an autonomous agent, you know, embedded into a system, you know, getting up to all kinds of crazy nonsense, we've got to understand that you know it really does work differently. And we've got to remove those trust relationships as much as we can to limit the potential damage that can happen because of a malicious or modified AI system.
I think inherent in the design of today's AI systems is a critical flaw, and it's one we repeated since the 1960s. It's in-band signaling. If you go back to the old SS5 and John Draper, a.k.a. Captain Crunch, discovering that the nice little whistle in the box of cereal will blow 2600 hertz, which was a control signal. But that was in-band signaling. The data was interpreted as a command. And so as a result, that created the entire issue. They've, of course, moved to out-of-band signaling. But anytime you do in-band commands, you have the risk because the data is now executable code. We did that with macros, and then we had the whole problem with people sending macros in Excel documents and things like that. So as we look at the concept of zero trust and AI in the signaling, we can't change the architecture. The vendors aren't going to change that architecture. But what do we do to convince our strategists as we roll out this AI that we need to have these very close controls? And I think you've alluded to that with regard to things like an AI firewall, which is still really in their infancy. We're still figuring that stuff out.
They really are. So, you know, I mean, we've got things like API firewalls or web app firewalls for the same reason. But the idea is, I mean, you know, with a guardrail, right, it's native to the AI system. And, you know, ChatGPT or Gemini, you know, well, they know they're not supposed to violate copyright law. And people will be clever about working around them, right? You can trick a system to give you anything if you say, well, I'm writing a story, I'm running a play. Can you play along? That kind of man in the middle is really important, right? Because when you hear the news stories from whatever vendor of the week that has discovered a new vulnerability in AI systems, well, I mean, it's really about trust. And, you know, I think what we look at when we're seeing those prompt injection kind of techniques, it's taking those attackers, you know, days or weeks potentially to iterate, to find and craft the right prompt to get in. But again, going back to the way we've been doing security for years, why do we let them iterate? Why don't we block them after the first attempt? Why don't we force a reauthentication to see if that's really the end user? And what does that require? Well, the thing that an AI firewall gets you is it gets your AI system into your security stack. Right. You're getting those logs. Right. So with AI, everybody knows the MITRE ATT&CK framework. MITRE has also created the MITRE ATLAS framework, which is the same kind of TTP concept as applied to AI systems. Right. Anytime you're hitting a MITRE ATLAS kind of related attack, we should be logging that in our SIM and doing something about it, whether it's a firewall block of an IP or something along those lines. To make sure that our systems are good, we're doing the same things, right? We're still following our zero trust strategy, but you know we're being integrated, just like we need to be as a part of every other aspect of our security program.
So that's an excellent insight. Is that as we roll out AI, we want that to be part of our security stack, so we can capture the logs, we can correlate it, we can take a look at things. Because we give these AI systems almost unfettered access, and we have a lot of control over what humans can see and what they can do. We don't want Bobby the intern querying the AI system and getting this quarter's financial information ahead of when it goes to the SEC. It would not be a good thing. And so as a result, we've got these challenges, but we've got the tool sets to do so. And the concept of a zero trust of a strategy where do not assume that two different systems can talk to each other forever without revalidating who they are. And do not assume that any particular communications channel is fully trusted. That is to say, nobody can clomp onto the wire, so to speak, and listen in on the conversation. And at the basic level where we're doing that, and the point-to-point encryption is pretty easy, and the authentication, because we have the ability to do so, is pretty easy. And so as we implement that, do we find out that we actually get a reduced cost and reduced complexity, or is it just one more level of difficulty that we put on our security stack?
You know, I don't think it's that high a degree of difficulty, right? I mean, the most AI firewalls work exactly like a proxy. We know how what proxies work. Mm-hmm. You know, with you know, integrating into our SIM with you know, automation, our SOAR tech, you know, stack, go on and doing something about it. I think, you know, again, you've got to understand how your business operates, right? If you're driving a self-driving car, you know, it's a very different risk profile. And you know, you want to make sure that the training is right, right? You didn't trick your model into, you know, thinking a stop sign is a green light. Right. So those kinds of things, you know, again, I think we've gotten better in the last decade about, you know, doing security testing before we're throwing things into production. But that comes back full circle to what we talked about earlier with culture, right? You want your teams to be asking before they deploy their new AI, you know, whiz bang tool, that they worked with us to make sure we've figured out some of the challenges. We've done a pre-mortem or a red teaming exercise before we're throwing things into production, and hopefully we're part of the development pipeline as well, so that, you know, we're thinking about all those other aspects along the journey.
Got it. So I'm a CISO. I've gone ahead. I've ordered and read your book, Project Zero Trust. I've been adventuresome and read Rise of the Machines. I've got a meeting with the board later today to talk about my Zero Trust initiative that I want to propose to them. What do I say?
I love talking to boards because it really resonates with them. I think more so than ever, we've gotten a seat at the table. Having that seat at the board table means, you know, we've got to deliver not just problems but solutions. So when it comes to AI, right, I think people are already asking the questions, right? We've seen enough headlines to know, like, oh my gosh, we want to make sure this thing is secure before we deploy it. But also, you alluded to this earlier, like, everybody's just got AI fever. We got to go do it, you know, and do it today. So I think there's an opportunity for us to ask some clarifying questions that'll seed some good conversations later on. Like, cool, we want to do AI first. Why? Is it about a competitive edge? Is it about increasing productivity? What are those underlying factors? And, you know, I think the thing that's missing in a lot of conversations is, well, how do we know if those things paid off? Did our employees get more productive? How are we measuring those? That's not a security conversation. That's enabling the business to have a better conversation about what their outcomes are. And I think in security, you know, we can step in and talk about how we're going to secure those outcomes, right? And make sure those things are delivered. So that's my kind of off the cuff answer, is, you know, let's work with our CIO friends, or CTO or whatever your organization has to really respond and have a good story about how we're moving forward with AI and we're delivering the vision, at the same time that we're making it secure so that we're not, exposing, you know, our crown jewels.
Well, George, thank you very much. This has been a really interesting show, and getting into Zero Trust and the importance of it as a strategy, exploring how it impacts with AI, and just your deep knowledge of the subject has been really, really wonderful. So I thank you on behalf of our listeners here at CISO Tradecraft. Now, if you want to learn more about George, you want to learn about his books or get a copy of his books, I'm going to put some links in our show notes here, so you can go ahead and pick them up. Presumably, they're available on Amazon, right?
Absolutely, and Audible. So
and Audible.
Let me leave your guests wanting more. So the audiobooks, we got one of the actors from The Walking Dead to be the narrator. So that has just been the coolest part of this whole process is hearing an actor from The Walking Dead, reading my books. So definitely check them out.
Well, definitely sounds great. So for our viewers and listeners, if you're not subscribing to CISO Tradecraft, please do so. You can go ahead and follow us on LinkedIn. You can also follow us on any number of channels in terms of your favorite podcast channel or even YouTube. We have a Substack newsletter that we put out every week that's also useful as well. And share it with others so they know where you get your knowledge. This is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thank you very much for listening. And until next time, stay safe out there.